This is Bishop Phoebe Rofe from the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. Each Thursday morning, we broadcast on WYXR 91.7 FM out of Crosstown Concourse in Memphis, and we have the opportunity to interview an individual or persons in the community to learn more about their life and their ministry. So each Thursday, we start with a saint of the day, and today, which is September the 29th, we have the feast day of Saint Michael and all angels. The Bible talks about many angels. There are lots of references to angels in the Bible, but did you know that only four angels are specifically named? Those four are Michael, Gabriel, Uriel, and Raphael. Michael, sort of seen as the leader of the heavenly host of angels, is an important figure not only in Christianity, but also in the Jewish and Muslim faith traditions, and he has a counterpart among the Babylonian and Persian angels. Jews believe that Michael is the special guardian of Israel, and in Christianity, it is Michael who will sound the last trumpet on the judgment day and escort the souls of all the faithful departed into the presence of God. The veneration of Saint Michael as an archangel dates back to the earliest days of the church. He is the patron saint of the sick in the early Christian traditions. And he is seen as someone who wards off evil from God's people and who delivers peace to them at the end of our life's mortal struggle. So on this day, we do remember not only the Archangel Michael, but all of the angels in the Bible who are examples to us of messengers from God, visible or invisible, human or non-human, who convey helpful messages to help us in our earthly journey. And the prayer that is assigned for the feast of Saint Michael is as follows. Everlasting God, who has ordained and constituted in a wonderful order the ministries of angels and mortals, mercifully grant that as your holy angels always serve and worship you in heaven, so by your appointment they may help and defend us here on earth through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. So this morning, we are very pleased to have with us Pat Morgan. We're here to talk to her about her recently published book, We Hardly Knew Them, How Homeless, Mentally Ill People Became Collateral Damage. Pat is an Arkansan, as I am, and is a graduate of Rhodes College and has many, many years of work with the homeless community and working on behalf of those who are mentally ill, some of the most vulnerable members of our community. So, Pat, good morning and welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Pat, we normally start the show by asking our guests what the role of faith in their life was when they were a child. So did you grow up going to church?
I was a fixture at church.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very much so. In fact, I was I spent my first 40 years in the Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a very small town, population 535 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Methodist Church was there. And actually, when they'd have the summer things, they would call my parents and say, you have to get the Phillips kids here, because if you don't, we can't have the thing. There won't be enough kids. So from there, it began very early.
Mm-hmm.
And it has never left me.
Mm-hmm.
It's never left me. All the Bible stories that we heard then, I mean, I loved all that, but every time they got to the one about Noah drowned in the ark, and I would just get all flustered. I said, no, I don't like that one.
Yeah.
I don't think God's going to drown all the babies in the world.
Yeah.
But that, I was there until I graduated from high school, went off to college. I had 1 year at Arkansas State, where I was a cheerleader. And loved every minute of it. But then my dad was a deputy sheriff, and he was shot and killed in the line of duty.
Mm.
So there was no going back to school. My birth mother had left when I was about 4, and we never saw her again.
Mm-hmm.
But my stepmother was there, so she was a stepmother. Okay, mm-hmm. She was not like a real mother, but as my dad said, what mothers do for their children, they do because they're their children. What she does for you, she does out of the goodness of her heart.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we were always, and then by the time I was in junior high, we moved next door to the church.
Wow. Convenient. Very convenient.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And the school was across the street.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really a fixture there. And I sang in the choir, and I got to be the angel when we did our Christmas thing, because nobody else wanted to memorize the stuff. So I had a good introduction to faith very early on.
Great.
Very early on.
Great. So the book, We Hardly Knew Them, is filled with so many powerful stories about persons who suffer from mental illness and end up homeless. And I wonder, what is it that drew you to have a desire to serve this particular community?
I had always had, we were poor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those first few years that I remember, my dad had a furniture store, and there were apartments along the side of it. It had a kitchen and a bathroom, but basically we sort of lived in the store, and we lived on the wrong side of the tracks, which I kind of liked, because we had a honky-tonk next to us and a Chinese grocery behind us. So I grew up knowing people as people.
Mm-hmm.
Not as somebody that was different from me, although they still couldn't go to school with us. And I always wondered and was not happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always sort of in the back of my mind. And there were, when I graduated and then I went into banking, I was file clerk. And so I was not doing much for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the Methodist Church there in West Memphis for a long time, but we weren't really doing any outreach. I was doing some on my own. But then I got into politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it really started happening. It's not enough to care about people. You have to be able and want to do something to make their lives better.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up getting very involved in trying to help people register to vote and be able to live like regular people, go to a restaurant if they wanted to, any restaurant they wanted to. So I did a lot politically there. And then I had divorced my husband. He was an alcoholic and wasn't getting any better. And as soon as my 3 sons were old enough that I knew that they would be in school most of the time and I could take care of them, I had to have that down. So I was single for several years, and then I remarried, which frankly was a disaster. But he was a good man in many ways, but he was not really who I was looking for. But at any rate, we moved to Memphis, and I found Calvary Episcopal Church.
Yes.
We went to hear the Messiah once, and then I was hooked, completely, utterly hooked, because I'd sung in the choir all my life and sung in the choir over in the Methodist Church. But the priest, Doug Bailey, was just phenomenal. When he came in, he just revived the church. But he would go out and just walk down the street, you know, and they just, we call them the street people. They would just flock to the church. They would just, he was the Pied Piper.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I got a message from him and said, I'm looking for volunteers to help this with the people who are coming in. There's so many of them, I can't sit and talk to them. So I volunteered to do 2 hours one afternoon a week. And I walked in the first day, and there were about 10 to 12 of the sickest men I'd ever seen in my life,
mm-hmm.
mentally, physically. And I was hooked. Mm-hmm. I spent the next 5 years. I mean, I was there every afternoon, every weekday afternoon, for 5 years, helping to develop a program and then working with them, 50 to 100 drunk, psychotic street people every day.
Mm-hmm.
And it just simply, we brought in outreach workers, we brought in the mental health people, we brought in health care. It was helpful there. But it wasn't enough for the sickest ones, the ones who were severely mentally ill, schizophrenic, bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
We just couldn't get them inpatient treatment, and they just desperately needed it. And in fact, I was beating the doors down to MMHI, and finally the director told me, he said, Pat, you know they're committable. I know they're committable. But I can't commit them because I don't have a bed.
Mm.
He wasn't talking about furniture.
Right.
He was talking about he didn't have the staffing to admit more people.
Right.
And that was against the law for him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so frustrated, but we had brought in outreach people, and we brought in mental health professionals who could help calm down some of them, although actually when they're really acting out, a small woman is the best person.
Okay.
No big guys in there. We don't want any big guys.
Right, right.
They want to fight then. But anyway, I was the stories that they were telling me,
mm-hmm.
and some of them you knew from listening, they were psychotic,
mm-hmm.
And we just couldn't get help for them. So I stayed, and it just wasn't getting any better. But we had a lot of good people working there, and I decided that I needed to go back to college.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mental health professionals were sort of patting me on the head, like, oh, well, you know, you didn't know this, but we
right.
did. So I went back to college out at Rhodes. They had a special class for non-traditional students,
mm-hmm.
which meant old people and people of color.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I could not let go. I mean, I was mm-hmm. determined to make a difference in mm-hmm. their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I changed my major 4 times, finally wound up in political science, which, mm-hmm. which is a good thing. And so then I was very fortunate that my professor decided I needed to go to Washington. And mm-hmm. I already knew Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I had campaigned for him for years, and he was wonderful. He mm-hmm. was just wonderful. And I knew that somewhere or other he would help. And I knew that he was thinking about going to run for president.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really on my mind. I was going to go to Washington to figure out, find my way into some policymaking group
mm-hmm.
with no money, no nothing. I had enough to last me for that first semester. But I went, and then I interned in Al Gore's office
mm-hmm.
because I knew he was very, very open and a really good person. And he cared about people with mental illness, and he cared about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I did that, and then just as I finished that up, I was temping around town, just hanging on.
Mm-hmm.
I had family. I had my mm-hmm. brother and 2 sisters who would bail me out anytime I needed them, but I didn't want to do that. So then when Bill Clinton announced he was running for president, I jumped on his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And worked on the campaign full time, and then they came over, and I was doing a lot of writing for him because I knew how he spoke, and I knew he cared about homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he cared about mentally ill people. So mm-hmm. I was driven, just
mm-hmm.
driven. So I did that, and then when they came over and told me they wanted me to run the transition office with correspondence. So I went over there and ran that whole thing. And then when it was over, I walked over to the White House with the last box of letters and said, I want to work on homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So they handed me the plum book. The plum book is this plum-colored book with all the plum jobs in it. So here was one. It was to the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know it existed. There really is a God.
Yes.
There really is a God. So I went there, and then I worked for 7 years with that, helping to develop programs and implementing programs for homeless, mentally ill people.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't do the outreach. I couldn't do the street outreach that I was accustomed to doing. I wasn't seeing the people one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
I was so busy with the other stuff because it was 18 hours a day, you know, 6 or 7 days a week. But the drive was still there. It was mm-hmm. all still for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came home, I was assigned on as director of Partners for the Homeless, and this is where God really showed up again, you know, because I really wanted to work one-on-one with them because that's what I love doing. Mm-hmm. So I was offered a position, and I thought, I don't know about that. It was Director of Partners for the Homeless, and would be developing the system which would help them, but it wouldn't give me the one-on-one that I thought. So, as I often do, when I went to bed that night, and I said, Lord, I need a sign. So I got up the next morning and went out and opened the door, and there was the newspaper, and the headlines in inch-to-high font said, 10 care cuts mean more homeless, mentally ill. So I signed up. I took a $10,000 cut and signed up for the job.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would still continue to work with the sickest ones, the ones that I knew before, and I would see them on the street because I lived downtown a lot mm-hmm. then. And so that part just never left me. But then the frustration with not being able to help them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter what I did, I couldn't get them into the treatment they mm-hmm. needed. So I retired, and then I had finished writing my first book, and that was all about the street people.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about it, except it turned into a memoir because I realized that they were changing my life. And
yeah.
when I was talking to them of what they needed to do to get their lives in order, it was bringing back everything that had come to me. So it was like a joint thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then my all-time favorite homeless person, Alopecia, had died, and that just broke my heart. I mean, mm-hmm. we lost a lot of them, but he was very special. So I'm just hooked.
Yeah.
I guess I can just say hooked. I'm hooked on homelessness, homeless people.
Yeah.
And I still am. I really want to get back out there.
Yeah. And for our listeners, her first book is called The Concrete Killing Fields, One Woman's Battle to Break the Cycle of Homelessness. I love, Pat, your comment that often when we engage in ministry, something that we're passionate about, as a quote-unquote expert, right? We're the ones who end up learning and being ministered to. And we find that there's a mutuality to it.
Absolutely. One of my favorite stories is that Doug Bailey was a marvelous, is a priest. And he would hold little sermons and little meetings in the one of the, they called it the forgotten what the name of it was. It was downstairs in the basement of the
uh-huh.
church. And one day he was preaching about the prodigal son.
Mm.
And so Michael, who was one of my favorites, got up and walked out. And, of course, we had people in there. They were, you know, some of them were drunk. One man was lying on the floor, and every time Doug would say something, he'd raise up and holler, repent, which was not a bad idea. But it was, anyway, I walked out because I was laughing, and I didn't think I should be laughing during a sermon. And so his name was Joe, and mm-hmm. he followed me in, and I said, Joe, you need to go back in there. They talk about the prodigal son. And he said, I ain't listening to that story anymore. He said, He said, I went home like that one time, and my mama got after me with a 45.
The welcome was a little different. Yeah.
And he said, now, I don't buy that thing about God drowning everybody in the world anyway. And I said, well, I don't either. And he said, well, you know, he said, I've forgotten exactly how he put it. He said, did you know that he got drunk, that Noah got drunk and passed out naked in the tent? And I said, no, he didn't. So he opened the Bible and
showed you where it was. Yeah.
So that's been the one piece of scripture that I have avoided at all costs. And it's always a good idea when people start doing all these things. I'll be the only ones unless you're going to be talking about that.
Yeah.
But they enriched my life beyond measure.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't imagine how I could go home every day and feel like I had at least tried to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that God got me out of a lot of trouble.
Yeah. You know, I have noticed since COVID started an increase in homelessness. And because of all of the mental health issues with the isolation, things have changed here in Memphis. And the problem can seem so daunting, like so overwhelming. For someone who is seeing homeless persons in their neighborhood or their community and sensing that some people may be talking to themselves, there may be a mental health issue. Do you have any thoughts about small steps that people can take who want to help, but who may really feel like the problem is so vast, I don't even know where to start?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There is one thing that anybody with a telephone or a computer out there can do.
Okay.
One thing that I write about, the main thrust of that second book, the collateral damage.
Yes.
It's a direct result of some legislation that was done half a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
When the Medicaid Act was passed, they also passed what they call the Institutions of Mental Disease Exclusion.
Yes.
Okay. What that does, it's a discriminatory thing on the face of it. Because poor people are the ones who get Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it did, it prevents people aged 22 to 64, when they are most likely to need it,
mm-hmm.
from using their Medicaid to pay for treatment in an institution of mental disease, a.k.a. a state psychiatric hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So they cut the funding.
Okay.
We went from having more than 500,000 beds, we have fewer than 40,000 today.
Oh, wow.
And jails and prisons are de facto mental health facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
But they call that act the touch it and die. For politically. You touch
okay.
that one and die politically, because nobody wants to spend that kind of money on mentally ill people.
I see.
But now it's so bad in the jails and the prisons, and there's so many that are dying on the streets, and they're being beaten up,
mm-hmm.
you know, because people don't know what to do.
Right.
They don't know how to reach them, and some of them are so sick that you can't reach them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're standing out there screaming at the light post, they are seeing things and hearing things that you and I don't see or hear.
Right.
And there's no telling what those voices
mm-hmm.
and images are telling them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also what we've learned through the Treatment Advocacy Center and Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, he's done more research into schizophrenia than anybody out there. But what they now know, in all those years I was telling people, they're so sick they don't know they're sick.
Right.
There's a word for that. It's called anosognosia. And what that means is 50% of the people with schizophrenia have it. So they're unable to accept and internalize that they have a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot to get them to accept the treatment, you know, the medications.
Right.
And about 40% of those with severe bipolar disease.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all those folks out there who are they're still so sick they don't know they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
But what we need to do, and what people could do, all we need you to do is call, write, email, text, however you can get to the state senators, to the U.S. senators.
Okay.
and the U.S. congressmen and tell them you want them to repeal the IMD exclusion. That you demand that they do it or you won't vote for them anymore. Because they're all running scared. They're afraid they're not going to get elected if they spend too much money. And it's just a, it's just a disaster. And I was very hopeful that we would get some of that change during this administration. And I think it's heading that way. But they need to repeal it. Doc, there's a congresswoman in California, Napolitano. I think her name is Grace Napolitano. And she has introduced that legislation. And we need them to support her with that. And that would make all the difference in the world. And even our state legislators and our county legislators, if they had, if, can you imagine what would happen? We could almost empty the county jails. And the city jails and the prisons, if we could get those mentally ill people out of it. But then we also have to have what everybody that is talking about now, and I'm working with a lot of different groups, the National Shattering Silence Coalition, which is made up primarily of mothers of mentally ill offspring, and they have just, they're pulling their hair out because they can't get treatment for them. And I was on a conference call with one of them, with several of them one night. On the, I'd signed up as an advisor to the board. But one of them had just buried her son, and one got a phone call during it, and she had to leave because her son was in jail and had just been stabbed. So these are the folks that you're working with. There are all kinds of groups out there. And, in fact, at the end of the book, I put where to go for help and hope. So all those pieces are in there in the back of the book, and it wouldn't cost people a dime, maybe a few minutes of their time. They could also call the White House comment line. We used to have them when they answered it, they actually answered it and listened to you. They don't do that anymore, but they do get the messages, you know, and they what they do is count the messages. So there are all kinds of things you can do. You can count, you can call them, you can do all kinds of things. And if we don't have a groundswell to do it, it's not going to happen. And we also need to change the HIPAA laws because the parents who know what's happened to their sons and daughters and have tried for years or decades to try to help them, they can't help them. They cannot even, they can't be any part of the mentally ill person's decision on what he's going to do. And that's, it's insane, really. I've got some wonderful books, too. Ron Powers wrote No One Cares About Crazy People. He had formerly won a Pulitzer Prize. And he's one of he's the best writer I've ever read. And he his he has two sons, had two sons, and they both were finally diagnosed with schizophrenia. And the toughest part about that is one of them died. He went down in the basement and he sensed that something was different and that someone else was in the basement. And he turned around and it was his son and he had hung himself. And his other son has schizophrenia, so he's at home. So I've got all sorts of, these people just know so more and have experienced so more that they've become my best friends. So those groups, I mean, all of that is in the back, but there are books that I, NAMI Memphis, I strongly encourage people to go to that. They're very, very committed. So I'm doing all I can do. And I wish I could. Actually, I wasn't even going to write that book, but I got mad. I'd had one guy that I was working with him. I was doing Room in the Inn, but I told Lisa, who's the brilliant, wonderful director of that, I said, I would like to do this, but I can't just do radical hospitality. I can't just come in and serve the food and be nice to them and all that kind of stuff. Besides, I'm a lousy cook. I don't want to cook. But I said, if you, if I can't help them, I don't want to do it. And she said, "Well, we didn't say you couldn't do it. You know what you're doing, so you come on." So as long as I didn't make a ruckus or something, I did that. So I went in and I would pick out the quietest person in the room, or the one who was most disruptive, because those were the ones who were most likely to be mentally ill. And then I'd pick out one and start working with them and try to get them. And then I could hook them up with outreach workers from one of the mental health centers and get them to the hospitality hub, And we managed to get some fixed like that into housing. But some we just couldn't get in. And the one that really, really sent me over the loop or whatever we want to call it, he was a young man, and he was very nicely dressed. He was well-educated. His table manners were really nice, and he just didn't look like he should be homeless, but he wasn't screaming at the telephone poles or doing anything like that. So, but I kept sitting with him when we were having dinner at the room in the inn. So one day I said, "What happened?" And I said, "Why are you out here?" Which is what I asked all of them, okay? But I waited a while for him. I said, where are your parents? You shouldn't be homeless. Where are your parents? And he said, they just don't understand. He said, I have to be able to run out to my auditions anytime I want to, and they just don't understand. They try to make me stay home. And I said, well, do you have a house? And you have housing? And he said, no, they offered me one, but it was a pittance. It was just a pittance. And I said, do you get a check? And he said, it's a pittance. I wouldn't accept it. And I said, well, what about the Union Mission? I could talk to them over there, and they would help you. They'd let you stay there for free. And he said, I couldn't stay there. He said, I can't rehearse my dance routines. He said, you don't understand. I'm being infused with fluids for Lionel Richie, 4 and 5 times a day. And that's why I'm so talented. So Room in the Inn closed a few weeks later, and he was out sleeping behind the dollar store on Poplar Avenue. And someone went back there and stomped and beat him to death. He lived about 2 weeks when in the hospital, but his chest was so crushed there was nothing they could do with it. So the ones I've lost, I mean, haunt me. The ones that are still out there that I can't get to haunt me.
Well, sounds like you have experienced a lot in what really feels to be a calling, a ministry to you. And I wonder, over the years, has your work with this community impacted your relationship with God, or how you understand who God is? I mean, what have years of being involved as an advocate for the mentally ill and the homeless, how's God played a role in that?
It's supported me, answered my prayers most of the time.
Yep.
Can't save somebody that doesn't want to be saved.
Right.
Who's too sick. But it's made me far more cognizant of my place in the world and who people are and how to love even the people that aren't very lovable, which is kind of hard today with the problems that we're going through. But it's always been a part of me from the first day. When I was about 9 years old, I remember skipping down the street. And it was that was when you could skip down the street and you wouldn't get mugged. Or worse. And it was like I was looking up at the moon and I was just totally open. And I felt this rush. And I have never doubted God since then. I have never doubted that he's been with me. I know I've disappointed him many, many times, but I've always felt forgiven. And then when my sons when the pandemic came out, my middle son had COVID and a stroke.
Oh, wow.
And if you want something to really deepen your faith, that's it. Because I was terrified, just beyond terrified, heartsick. And I remember one evening I was just hysterical almost, and I was crying, and I fell down on my knees beside my bed, and I said, "Lord, I can't do this by myself." And there are people out here going to think I'm crazy, but I heard this very kind male voice say, "I got this."
Yeah.
And I mean, that's been so much deeper, and I think I was just always driven. I knew it was where I was supposed. I knew that I was where I was supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
doing what God wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whatever flack I got from it, or whoever didn't like it, it didn't really matter much.
Yeah,
I knew I was doing what I knew God wanted me to do.
Yeah,
and now singing. That's been there my whole life.
Okay? They say when you sing, you pray twice.
You pray twice. Mm-hmm. And one of that favorite song of mine that you played at first, mm-hmm. is when I go out and God, this is my, our Father's world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm an outdoor person. I love being outdoors. So how can you look at the sunset? I'm not big on sunrises.
Mm-hmm.
That one almost blinded me this morning coming in.
Yeah.
And I'm not a morning person. But it's all there, and I wonder, and I think, how can anybody, and that's been me my entire life, how can anybody not know there's a God?
Mm-hmm.
But he's been with me through thick or thin. Mm-hmm. I never doubted him. I've never thought that this is what God's plan for me is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that God's plan is somebody to get hit by lightning or to get struck by a car or any. That's not God's plan for me, you know. And it, you know, I've just bathed in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just really fortunate. I'm really fortunate that I've come so far and haven't gotten myself killed.
Well, for those of you who are really interested in learning more about the stories of the homeless, about the policies and legislation that have helped to contribute, and who would like to have more resources. This book, We Hardly Knew Them, by Pat Morgan, is so helpful. So, Pat, if people are interested in getting a copy of your book, where can we get copies?
Episcopal Bookshop.
Which is at St. Mary's Cathedral.
That's right.
Great.
That's right. And I'm donating them to them.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay. And I'm also donating them to Novel.
Okay. So Novel Bookstore also in Memphis.
But you got to pay for them there.
Exactly.
You have to pay for them at the bookstores.
Great.
And if you absolutely can't afford one, call me and I'll give you one.
Great.
Amazon, it's on Amazon. You can order it from Amazon.
Great.
And that would be very nice too.
Right.
I have a lot of them in there.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for your compassion and your faithfulness to serve a community that, quite frankly, many people are afraid to interact with. So I wonder, as we conclude this section of the show, if you might share with our listeners, what is giving you a sense of hope right now? Are there things or signs of hope that you can see even in the midst of all of the issues that we're facing?
It's pretty tough right now. I just keep thinking that this is our Father's world.
Yeah.
And he will win at some point. But we really, the hope is really, I guess, coming from those parents.
Yes.
Because they are not going to give up.
Right.
They are not going to give up. And there are other organizations now of people who are in the mental health field.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk all the time about mental health. We need to be talking about mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's about mental health. You had a headache. You were mean to your wife. All these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But we are talking about severe mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
I always have hope.
Yes.
I always have hope. I get disappointed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take a whole lot more than we're doing now, and that's why I'm so militant about trying to get people to understand what we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
We can't wait for the government to do it without us telling them what we want,
right?
What we have to have, and then explaining to them how much money they'd save.
Correct.
How much money would you save? The jails are full of people. You know, the lawsuits that they get when they die or murdered in jails and prisons, all that stuff. I mean, you could do housing. We need housing that heals, not just housing, because they're still sick.
Right. So they need services and support. Yes.
And it has to be with people who understand. Laurie Powell with Alliance Healthcare, she's doing a lot to try to develop more than that, and she gets it.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be what the parents now are calling housing that heals. It's not enough for you to stuff me in some rooming house where I'm paying somebody and giving them all my check,
right,
and I'm not getting any kind of help. But there are some that really do provide that.
Mm-hmm.
we're not going to end mental illness, but there are some research out there that's really cutting edge that Dr. E. Fuller Torrey has done, and I encourage people to go to his website, the Treatment Advocacy Center. And until we enlighten, I won't say educate. I don't want anybody to educate me unless I'm sitting in a classroom. I'm real stickler on that. But until we enlighten people, until people really understand what's happening and what can be done, but it has to be a groundswell. It'll have to be that, or they will not pass that legislation. And if they don't pass the housing legislation that goes with it, it still won't work. They have to have the housing.
Got it.
HUD's doing a good job of trying to change that around, but when we did the what we call the continuum of care, when I was in Washington, we left out the part they could not use their... You couldn't admit people into the permanent supportive housing if they were coming straight out of the hospitals because they wanted the states to pay for that.
Yeah, so that's the conflict over whether the federal government or the state government will cover the cost.
So we have to show them that the counties and the states will provide the housing or at least the services to the housing.
Right.
And if we can get that done, we've got a better chance of getting there. But the other thing is when you see them on the streets and they're panhandling, I mean, some of them are mentally ill. Some of them, most of them aren't, probably alcohol and drugs. But they say, what do you say when they ask you for it? I just look them in the eye very gently and say, I wish I could. I wish I could covers a lot of territory.
Right.
I wish I could give it to you and you wouldn't spend it on alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
Okay, I wish I would give it to you and it would help you be housed and all that kind of stuff. But I want to try to lead them to the system, the programs that can help them. But I never give up on God.
Great.
I never have. I never will.
Well, thank you so much, Pat. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So welcome back to Faithfully Memphis. We hope that this conversation this morning about how we might be more connected with those who suffer from mental illness and all the issues connected with that has motivated you to perhaps get involved in some way. Just a reminder that next Thursday, the Reverend Dr. Jesse Abel, who is one of the priests at Grace St. Luke's Church, will talk with Daryl Willis, who created a business during a journey with cancer to learn more about how creativity was actually part of his self-care routine. A reminder that you can listen to Faithfully Memphis anywhere that you hear podcasts, including Apple Music and Spotify. So we encourage you not only to listen to us, but also to like us on the various platforms and to also give us any comments or feedback on topics and things that you would like to hear in upcoming episodes. So until next time, friends, stay safe and stay positive.